Hi, everyone, and welcome again to another one of my Podbean podcasts and YouTube videos on GowdyMitzBiz22.com. I am Larry Chapp, as most of you know. Quick note, I've gotten a lot of emails from my readers and so on saying, how come you haven't had a lot of writing output lately? And I haven't. I've been on speaking engagements. I have some more coming up. And also, I do live on a farm, and this is goat kidding season. I don't mean to. We've had a lot of goat kids born, and I've been staying up late watching goat kids get born and dealing with, milking and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, it's been a busy couple of weeks for me, but I'll get back on the wagon of writing very soon. Anyway, I'm excited. I have a couple of repeat guests. We have Dr. Bill Portier, an old friend of mine, a retired professor of theology from Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg and the University of Dayton. Also, my friend Mike Baxter, who teaches at Regis University and also at Notre Dame in South Bend. I've known both of these fine gentlemen for more decades than I care. You know, Bill, when I first met you, we were both young and handsome, but we both had hair. Yours was wild. But anyway, we're going to talk war and peace issues today. And this article was prompted by a previous conversation that I had with Mike Baxter and Benjamin Peters. And so, Benjamin, sorry, I didn't want to do a four-person thing today. Otherwise, I would have invited you to, if you're listening. But we'll do one with you again, too, buddy, very soon. But if you're open to it. But anyway, we were discussing war and peace issues. And I thought I want to do a deeper dumpster dive into these war and peace issues. And so in particular, we're going to begin with an article that was written in September of 1944 in Theological Studies by a Jesuit by the name of John C. Ford. And the long story, the name of the article was The Morality of Obliteration Bombing. And one needs to keep in mind that he wrote this while World War II was still going on. And the sort of background to this, long before, even before the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the atomic bombs, what a lot of people don't really realize is that the Allies, the British and the Americans in particular, had engaged in saturation bombing practices over German cities. And then later the Americans did the same over Japanese cities long before the dropping of the atomic bombs. We were dropping incendiary bombs on Tokyo, a city known for houses essentially built out of paper. And the United States did that on purpose, of course. And By all estimates, the saturation bombing in Japan killed more people than the atomic bomb. And there were millions killed by the saturation bombing of the Allies over Germany as well. So John Ford very bravely writes this article, pre-Vatican II, classic moral theology, right out of the Thomas playbook, where he condemned saturation bombing as immoral. As always immoral for reasons of just war. So I'm gonna first turn it over to Mike Baxter, and then Bill, you can interject anything you want as we go along. But I want Mike, just Mike, what thoughts do you have on the Ford article as we launch into this? I know that's a very open-ended question, but go ahead.
Well, I think that the Ford article represents an instinct and a capability in Catholic moral theology to call into question central practices of modern warfare. Ford was no pacifist. This is back when there were only a handful of pacifists, public anyway, who were Catholic, Dorothy Day being one of them. But what Ford shows in this article, I think, is that you can use moral theology, I guess, the discourse of moral theology and the precepts of the natural law to critique the waging of modern war. This article is kind of a moral analysis that really goes through step by step all the different aspects of that could be brought up. And he focuses in on, like, he doesn't focus in on the justice of the war itself. He stipulates, he doesn't argue, but he stipulates that I'll assume that World War II was just as the United States entered it. But he focuses then on the particular operations within the war. And he defines very carefully what he calls obliteration bombing or carpet bombing or area bombing. It's another term he uses. And then declares it to be unjust and immoral. So the title of the article is The Morality of Obliteration Bombing, but it could have easily been titled The Immorality of Obliteration Bombing, because that's the conclusion he reaches. The impressive thing about the article is the step-by-step careful way in which he marshals his argument. Larry, the fact that this was published, as you noted, in the summer of 1944 is remarkable in itself. And I have to confess, I don't know the history as to how this was received.
I don't either.
I do know
that Murray was the editor, right?
So it's interesting. It shows a capacity among moral theologians who were in favor of the war, the United States going to war, and the justice of the cause, to nevertheless raise these important issues about the Allies' prosecution of the war. And anyway, so it marks a bit of a landmark, and now it is included in anthologies that, you know, record historically the development of
there you go.
Including that one? What's that one, Bill?
It's one that I did with Scott Appleby and Patricia Byrne on it's on American Catholic intellectual traditions.
Yeah.
And I asked Germaine.
Germaine Grisey, for those listening.
I have to edit this section of this book on moral theology. Can you recommend like one or two pieces that you really think that I should put in? And the first one he said was this one.
The morality. Yeah, and it really does, I think, the way I would read it historically is it establishes a foothold for later critics of atomic and nuclear weapons, and for later critics of war in general, you know, including the Vietnam War, for example.
Yeah.
Because Ford critiques the notions of military necessity. He critiques the rhetoric of, if the enemy is doing it, we have to do it too. He goes into all this.
Just to be clear, by military necessity, what you mean is the moral rules can be bent if the boots on the ground situation demands certain nefarious practices simply for the success of whatever in military goal is at stake. All right. So, you know, so he argues against that. And all is not fair in love and war.
Exactly. I suppose you could set this off in an important way. Ford's position, and I would argue the Catholic tradition when it's being articulated properly, against the so-called realist or war is hell tradition. That is to say, all is fair in love and war. War is hell. You have the fog of war, and it just gets out of control, and it's not manageable. And you just try to do the least evil that you can. And what Ford wants to say in this article is, no, it is possible to adhere to the rules of international law, the laws of humanity, as he calls it at one point, and the natural law, as he derives it from Thomas Aquinas and the Scholastics. It is possible to adhere to those rules, and I guess this is the nub of the issue, refuse and avoid intentionally taking the lives of the innocent in war. And what he says is the natural law prohibits that absolutely, and the United States has been breaking that, and he explains why it's prohibited and why the United States should not do it.
And what's interesting to me is that he uses just war theory to make his case. He's, like you said, he's not a pacifist. So in just war theory, there's the principle that one must make a distinction between combatants and non-combatants. And that distinction Ford holds to be valid. And therefore, you cannot engage in saturation bombing. Anyway, Bill, you want to get your two cents in?
I mean, I would totally agree that this is just such a well-argued piece of moral theology. And it sort of represents what moral theology was like at its best before 1968.
Yeah.
This is what moral theology was like when I first encountered it. His big thing is that the direct taking of innocent life is always immoral. And there's like no way to get around that. Well, that sounds pretty familiar, huh?
Yeah.
And then the most impressive part to me was when I went back and reread this a couple of days ago, and it reminded me of, Larry, were you at the Mount in 1983?
Yes.
Did you go to see Bill Buckley's Dubois lecture?
Yes.
Do you remember it?
Very little.
It reminded me of, here's that.
Oh, there it is. There it is. Yeah. I don't really remember much about it at all.
It was about that there are no non-combatants.
Yeah, exactly. And that's an issue I want to bring up. So go ahead. And it's the issue of total war.
Yes. And he just kind of assumed that we were in that situation and that it was unrealistic to talk about non-combatants. But Ford goes through like that paragraph where he lists all of the people who, how can you say these are combatants?
Let me read some of that. Is that okay? I feel like we're going to focus. We're doing kind of a text seminar almost feel to this. And if we read it aloud, it'll give people like the impressive way he argues. He says, let us see for a moment what the abandonment of the distinction between combatants and non-combatants would mean in practice. And he says that it would mean that it is permissible to intentionally kill all the people on this list. And then he gives the list.
Yeah.
And here are some of the characters on the list, okay? Farmers, fishermen, foresters, lumberjacks, dressmakers, bakers, printers, millers, painters, paper hangers, piano tuners, cigar and cigarette makers, glove makers, hat makers, clerks in stores, decorators, window dressers, artists, authors, editors, reporters, janitors, housekeepers, domestic servants, secretaries, prison inmates, prison guards, institutional inmates, old men and women, all children with the use of reason from age 7, you know, like, and that's like,
and this goes on, it goes on for this huge,
it's huge, long thing,
the whole page. And he just really calls into question this idea of what you could call a totally militarized society, which is pivotal for trying to argue that you can take civilian lives. Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt there, but I just wanted to take that because I felt like we should read it at some point.
Yeah.
So you were talking about Buckley and
83. Well, Buckley just
William F. Buckley, right?
Yeah, William F. Buckley.
National Review.
He just had these, you know, he had this, he was such a great glib speaker, you know. And he had Nikita and Valerian, and one of them is a soldier, and one of them works in the bomb factory, and one of them is a farmer, but there's no distinction between them or among them. And he just takes that for granted, and he doesn't argue it. Like, you know, this his whole thing falls before Ford, you know. Like,
do you think, and this I think it's not a flippant question, do you think he really believed that, or do you think he was simply a shill for corporate powers?
Who, Buckley?
Buckley.
Well, I would say both. I mean, Buckley was a very rich dude, and I don't even know if he ever thought about. I mean, he was a Catholic, and he went to Yale in the 50s.
And he made his fame with that famous book, God and Man at Yale.
Yeah. And so I think he believed it. And like the end of the article was just amazing. He's talking about our freedom. It's like, this is the thing. But how much range has been given to you at Mount St. Mary's, finding yourselves a few steps from a library where you can read what you wish, a few miles from a bus and railroad and airplane stations where you are free to travel as far as your savings will take you, a few miles from political offices to which you have constitutional rights of access, and a few steps from a chapel in which you can pause to venerate that which alone is venerable. This, he's made a distinction between life, holding on to life at all costs and being willing to sacrifice it. And he at least was in the service. But it's this thing that you can do whatever you need to protect this ability to get on the train and go wherever you want.
Yeah, and I do remember one aspect of his talk, which was precisely that it's like a kind of idolatry. It's kind of a strange reversal of values, where he says it's a kind of, and you see this among advocates of the total war idea, that there's no such thing as non-combatants, that it's almost like those of us who say that it's intrinsically evil to deliberately kill non-combatants, that that's an idolatry of the present life, it shows that we don't really believe in the next life or something.
There were similar arguments during the pre-vaccine period of COVID, but that might be too
but you and I don't see eye to eye on the COVID stuff, so let's not
we won't get into that.
We don't want to ricochet the conversation.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say about Ford was,
not only that, if you say the wrong things about COVID on YouTube, you get banned. And now this will probably get banned for saying that. I don't know, we'll see.
So Ford, I said that Ford represented the best of moral theology as I learned it, but he also illustrates its weaknesses. And there was one point, I think it's on page 282, where he's talking about that, he's talking about the burden of proof. So that's a big part of his argument, that if you want to change the distinction, you have to, the burden of proof is on you. And then he says that you couldn't find any evidence to make your case in Catholic theologians, councils, bishops' conferences, popes. He doesn't mention Jesus. Doesn't mention the Gospels. And this is also a very, what Furphy calls an act-centered moral framework. It's thematically act-centered. I mean, he's looking at a big picture here, but it's thematically about acts. Can you do this?
But, you know, he does mention Christ at a couple of points.
Yes.
I know you picked this up.
But that's like, he was listing the sources there.
Yeah, I know.
The Gospels qualify.
But I what strikes me about this is that in the way he thinks that the Western civilization, as he understands it, has been infused with the charity of Christ to such a degree that our minds are clear and free to grasp and adhere to the natural law. I think that's the way he thinks.
Do you really think he thinks that?
Pardon?
Do you really think he thinks that?
I do. I think that he thinks.
I mean, don't they all think at this point? I know that that was.
And the popes think like that too, right?
Yeah, I know that. But don't you think at this point, like in the lead up to World War II and in World War II, that they're beginning to doubt that, and they're
and I
that's
do.
The point of the critique of modernity by someone like Belloc or something.
Yes, and I think that this article represents that transition point. You know, like
so he's trying to push to the back to the old way, or
yeah, because he talks about the future
from going
and how,
over the edge.
I mean, he uses the word barbaric, barbarians at several points, and not just the Germans, but the Allies. And so and one of his arguments toward the end of the essay is not only would it be like at one point he argues when he's taken on the principle of proportionality, obliteration bombing, he argues, is not effective in military necessity. And then he goes on, he goes, but let's look at it even further into the future. Obliteration bombing will unleash a kind of barbarism that we'll not be able to recover from. And I feel like this is a great example of someone who's using that old discourse to arrive at conclusions that later become more apparent, and maybe that coalesce somewhat with conclusions that Dorothy Day had been saying all along for different reasons. But if you're going to say there's two avenues of truth in Catholic theology, and one is revelation and one is reason, what impresses me about this article is he's leaning on reason to make these arguments, but he's coming to the conclusions that revelation-oriented thinkers like Dorothy Day and others are coming to as well. And so I feel like this is a great moment that has significance into the future once, you know.
And that's my interest in it, is the downstream, implications of what it is he has to say. I think Ford as well was an astute observer of history and understood that in modern warfare, we have a different beast than say more ancient wars involving mercenary armories isolated out in a field someplace, facing each other, shooting their muskets or charging each other with swords. Beginning kind of with the American Civil War, maybe a few other wars around that same era, you began to see slaughter on an unimaginable scale as old world tactics met new world machines. This reaches a high point in World War One and World War One especially. And I think he's looking out and is seeing, you know, there are barbarians at the gates here, and they're consequent. I'm thinking now of the fact that both Pope John Paul and Pope Francis have raised the fact that it might be the case that when we make, even within just war theory, when we're making prudential judgments about whether or not it's right to go to war or not, we have to take into consideration the absolute horror of modern warfare technology, and that there may be a case to be made that there is simply no way that modern wars can be fought without massive amounts of destruction to civilian populations. Go ahead, Mike.
So here's a passage where he's on the verge of saying that. This is on page 268. Man, I wish we were in a seminar, you know, with 12 students around a table.
That's right. We could open it up.
But it says here, if anyone were to declare that modern war is necessarily total, that is, without limit, and necessarily involves direct attack on the life of innocent civilians, and therefore that obliteration bombing is justified, my reply would be, so much the worse for modern war. If it necessarily includes such means, it is necessarily immoral itself. So like, I feel like he's breaking into this anti-total war, you know, like he's addressing this, he's seeing the implications, and anyway.
Well, one of the implications too, and I did my master's thesis on this under Germaine Griset, and I want to get your thoughts on this, Bill. You know, one of the implications is that therefore let's limit it to the United States, because that's where we're from. The American nuclear deterrent is inherently gravely immoral, and no Catholic should participate in it on any level. because it involves the directed targeting of civilian populations with weapons of unimaginable destructive force. And it clear and you know the Buckleys of the world would say, oh, it's just a deterrent, but there's intent there, and you're involving people in intent. So anyway, I'm going to turn it over to you, Bill, to talk about that a little bit, because you were close to Germain Grisez, and you know this argument well as well.
Yeah, it's based on the murderous intent, so it's pretty simple for him. There's no deterrent without a murderous intent. And a murderous intent is always gravely immoral.
And has to be rejected, yeah.
And then there are those who would say, and because the last time I said this online, a lot of people make comments that, hey, look, chap, if you're going to say no Catholic should ever be in a nuclear missile silo or in a nuclear strategy part of the Pentagon or whatever, then you're going to leave those positions to the barbarians. Better to have Catholics in those positions with some level of a conscience than to have no Catholics at all. But once again, I think that's a pragmatic argument that just doesn't float. But go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, the idea there is to Christianize the military without acknowledging that you're militarizing Christianity. I mean, that's the problem there. It's that if we become used to these awful things.
I don't know. I don't know if you were at this lecture. It was around the time of the Bishop's Pastoral.
I know what you're going to say.
Which lecture? Are you talking to me?
Germain. Lecture at the Mount.
Oh, yeah. I was there.
And I don't know if he ever published it. Well, you can correct me if I misremember it. So he made the whole argument about the murderous intent. But then he went through this whole scenario about what would happen if we gave up the deterrent and we would be taken over by the Russians and the church would be persecuted, but it would grow very strong. And then at the end, he goes through this whole scenario and then he says,
I know what you're going to say. Yeah, go ahead.
But it's not reasonable to expect that this is ever going to happen. and so therefore, and I think this is what he said, we should have the best damn deterrent possible.
He did say it. Oh, yeah, in that Cleveland nasal twang, you know, it's like, damn it, we should have the best deterrent possible, damn it.
One
of my colleagues says,
I know,
Germain, does this mean that we should have the best damn abortion clinics possible? Germain just went bonkers. It was great. He was dancing around like it was the end of the world. You know how people dance to the end of the world as we know it? That's what he was doing up there. So you remember this, right?
Oh, I remember it like it was yesterday.
Okay.
Because I was in Grisez's apartment not too long after that, having dinner with he and his lovely wife, Jeanette. And I brought that up, and he was still steaming from that question, still steaming from it. And I had to
sit. What did he say?
It's a failure of nerve.
Oh, well, I think.
But I mean, how did he answer that? Like, what, you know?
Well, I guess what I could glean was that abortion involves the active murdering of actual human beings, whereas the deterrent involves a murderous intent, but not the actual murdering of human beings. It was something. Grading. It was levels of evil, apparently.
Was he grading levels of intrinsic evil?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's the flaw. You can't do that.
Yeah.
And when Bill told me that story, I said, the argument failed there because he needs to appeal to some concept of providence, which he ends up doing when he teams up with Finnis and Boyle in the book Realism, Morality, and Nuclear Weapons. So the last chapter of that book says, if this means that the West must be defeated, we can't be detached to the West. And I just think that's it's both strong in its consistency.
It is better to, because classic moral theology. It's better to be the victim of a moral evil where you are not the perpetrator than to be the perpetrator of a moral evil. This is the essence of martyrdom. But I also think we take too easily the premise involved in that, which is, had we unilaterally disarmed on the grounds that the nuclear deterrent was grossly immoral and contrary to the moral values of the people of America, if we had done that, the thinking goes, well, the Soviet Union would have just taken us over. I don't think so.
So I actually don't think so. Here's my response to that. I'll ask the Stanley Hauerwas question. Who do you mean by we? And I think in that statement, you meant Americans. But what I would say is the Catholic Church should focus its pastoral efforts on, first and foremost, its own people, and on the embodiment of the teaching in its own ranks, I suppose you could say. And therefore urge Catholics and others, people of goodwill, to absent themselves from these situations, on nuclear bases and so on, and on ships, on Trident II submarines and so on. And the church really never succeeded after this challenge of peace in really evangelizing and forming people such that they would take that seriously. Now, it doesn't mean that if the Catholics, granted, okay, they're 20% of the U.S. population, if, 10,000 military people leave because of this type of moral discernment, it doesn't mean necessarily that there won't be other people to step in, but it will mean that the Catholics embody a seriously different alternative, an alternative way of looking at this issue and an alternative way at looking at the world. And so you can't deny that it's possible that this nuclear, what they call euphemistically nuclear exchange, would occur. But what you can say is, oh, the Catholics were right, or the natural law was right, or Jesus was right, and or some combination of those, and that we would become the kind of witness to another way than we turned
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. And that brings me, though, to, I know Bill has a different opinion on this than I do. I am of the opinion that the pastoral letter issued by the American bishops in the early 80s, I believe it was 84, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
83,
Challenge of Peace.
May 3rd, 1983.
It had some very strong statements about nuclear war, but at the end of the day, it allowed for the continuance of the of our participation in the Catholic participation in the nuclear on the grounds, so long as steps were being taken towards peace negotiations, disarmament negotiations, SALT treaties, those sorts of things. I consider that to be a cop-out. I think the bishops who were the bishops, the Catholic bishops, in the most powerful, the richest nation this has ever existed on planet Earth, with weapons of mass destruction unseen in human history, had a moral obligation to speak out prophetically and strongly condemning all of it, and they didn't. Now, I know, Bill, you have a slightly different take on that, I think.
Oh, my take involves that there was pressure
from above.
Bishops like Hunthausen and the peace bishops
were
very, very disappointed by that result. And it was my understanding that at that point, the Pope was negotiating with the president, Joe Fahey has an article about this.
Okay.
Trying to
Pope John Paul with Reagan
put pressure on the Russians and make them spend their way out, which their supporters would say they successfully did. But in order to do that, they had to water down this thing in the way that you suggest, and I attribute it to Vatican influence.
So
that could very well be. I also think it's absolute BS that the Soviet Union dissolved because Reagan increased our defense budget.
Yeah, but that's what you know,
that's the line. That's the argument, you know, and that this, I was just at the National Shrine of Our Lady of Częstochowa last week, which is down in Doylestown, PA. By the way, it fed my Polish soul because it's like Polish Disney World down there. It's fantastic. But they have a bookstore, and in that bookstore, there was a book. I wish I could remember the name of it. It was about Yay Thick hardback, and it was about Reagan and John Paul, this glorious alliance between these two wonderful people who brought down the Soviet Union. Now, I think John Paul did have a hand in bringing down the Soviet Union. John Paul remains one of my ecclesiastical heroes. I don't want to be overly critical of him. Nevertheless, that's the line. What I'm criticizing here is this is now the narrative, the storyline, and it's considered an unproblematic storyline. That's what bothers me. Oh, yeah, all these conservative Catholics saying, oh, yeah, yeah, this is great. Reagan and John Paul brought down the Soviet Union by increasing military spending by hundreds of billions of dollars and putting... No, I think, if anything, the Soviet Union came down through John Paul via his influence on Polish solidarity and the unraveling of the East Bloc and so on. I think it's more complicated than just, oh, we got more bombs and so on. Anyway, that's my rant of the day.
Yeah, I am. Never mind. I'll say something in a minute when I formulate it.
Okay. But Bill, I want to come back to you because all this, I mean, that's all well and good. We could argue a lot of these issues. But one of the reasons why I wanted you on the show today, because we brought your name up in our last podcast with Mike and Ben Peters, that you gave a paper in which you argued that the Catholic Church should develop a kind of liturgical ceremony of some kind, a ceremony of penitence or something. I don't remember the exact, where Catholic soldiers that come home from either war or, you know, deployment in dangerous places could go through a kind of prayer service that would help them heal their wounded souls. So maybe I love this idea, and I want you to talk about it a little bit.
Okay, I didn't know I was going to talk about it, but it's based on a line from Augustine, Animi Dolore, that even if you are practicing virtue in battle, what you are required to do causes animi dolore, sorrow of soul sorrow.
Yeah.
And there's, so I wanted us to have, you know, this was back in the 20 some years. This was back
in Iraq, right?
Yeah. I gave the first paper like that at a communio meeting.
In Virginia.
Yeah, that was like 2005.
Yeah, 2005.
And then I gave another one at Duke, which was one of the best conferences that I've ever been to in my life.
That summer conference on reconciliation, right?
It was called After the Yellow Ribbon. Mm. And it was organized by a veteran CO, and I think one of the guys from the Catholic Worker House in South Bend was there.
Sean Storr.
Yeah, Sean was there, and it had like psychologists, army psych guys, chaplains, instructors at West Point, pacifists, peace activists of various kinds. And after however many years of war it was, 12 or something, they were all in the same place. And yeah, it was just amazing. And the paper I gave there was a development of the one that I gave in 2005. But the idea was, it's based on like practices around the world, like what they do with child soldiers when they rescue them. They have rites. And like in the Middle Ages, before the Crusades, if you shed blood in battle, you had to do penance. And there's a great Notre Dame dissertation about that that I got from Fagerberg.
Steve Long wrote about that too in his dissertation, Duke.
And so the idea that that you do injury to your soul, and that traditionally there has been rights that, that the church provides to deal with that, is especially the idea of shedding blood, which is a biblical idea. Like when you shed blood, this creates that,
that's key. I had, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I remember I had a great uncle on my mom's side who was in Patton's Third Army in World War II and saw a lot of combat, part of that, that went into Germany and so on. And he used to, I mean, we didn't call it this then, but he had PTSD even 30 years later. And he told me one day, he didn't want to talk about it very much at all. But I asked him, I was older, and I said, Uncle George, so what really, it was a just war. I mean, I don't know if I use those words, but in some, you know, it was a good war. And that's, I mean, why do you feel guilty? And he did feel guilty. He says, because you can never forget the first time you kill another human being. You can never forget all the blood that, and he used this phrase, that's why what you said just triggered this in my brain. You can never forget that you have spilled human blood.
So it was very difficult. It is very difficult for me to work on this because it's basically about my father. And as I read all this stuff about moral injury, and I grew up with that.
There's a whole lot.
And I never knew what it was. I never understood why my father never went to bed. Like, we would go to bed and he would be sitting in the chair, and he would maybe be there when we got up, and he didn't sleep very much. He was actually classified by the VA as 33% disabled, but that was just physical. The rest of it was not on their radar, but it was really, the more I read about this, and so then it became very hard. So I never published this second article, which I thought was pretty good. I sent it to Commonweal, and they wanted me to do all sorts of things to it, but I didn't really have the heart. Then I sent it to the liturgist who is now retiring and used to teach at Duke and now teaches at Yale. Anyway, I sent it to her, and she...
Teresa Berger.
Yeah, Teresa Berger. And she gave me some various suggestions, and we talked about it. She said her father was in the German army, and we talked about that. And, but I just can't like work on it.
You know, one of the things we were doing in the Catholic Peace Fellowship, I think that's why Sean was at this conference, was trying to, you know, be present to returning soldiers. And like in that sense, I when I was at DePaul, I taught a course called Coming Home from War, and I'd get like 40 or 50 students. It was on Monday. It was on Tuesday nights, I guess it was.
Did you get Monday. Veterans?
Yes. It was about a third veterans, like, because DePaul had a big program for getting veterans to, you know, come to school there. And they were different branches and so on. And like the first class, I'd introduce the class for 10 minutes, and we watched Saving Private Ryan. That's the first class. And then we just watched movies or read books. And
could any of them not watch movies?
No, they all did it. They all did it.
Because my dad would never watch war movies ever.
Yeah, my dad would, and my dad was similar to yours. My dad had nightmares about the war 2 weeks before he died. And when I say the war, I mean Second World War. 2 weeks before he died in 1992. And so it's that thing where you learn what a person lives with their whole life who's been so close to you. But these guys, they would talk about it in different ways, and some would open up more than others. But it was a great experience, because it was what I like. They have a lot of programs with Jonathan Shea and these, you know, programs of people coming back from war and talking with each other about what it's like to go to war. But my my observation was the key for people coming home from war is to be able to talk about war, not just with soldiers and others who were in the war, but with people who weren't. Because part of the challenge of coming home from war is that you've been to another country, and the country you come back to, and the country's name is war. And then you come back, and the people that you love don't understand where you've been. And so, like, the real task is to get understood by people who have not been through that experience to the best extent that you could. So we had some great moments, you know, like we would see this great movie, Dear America, which is about just like soldiers writing home during the Vietnam War and so on. And I remember one class where one of the veterans talked about watching his friend get blown up by an IED in Iraq, and how he goes, and it's not like you think. It's like suddenly there's this pink mist, and that's it, you know. Like, and yeah. And one of the students kind of spoke across the room. We were on a big circle, and she said, "I've never understood what you're talking about till just now." And it was a great moment. And like at the end of that class, I said, "You know what? I think we've had one of the most important conversations in America this evening about what, you know, what it's like to go and to come back from war."
Because it's an actual description and discussion of what war is really like, instead of the jingoistic illusions that get peddled all the time. You know, in the little time we have left here, I do want to start talking about a little bit, and I'm going to set it up, a book that Bill turned me on to, War Made Invisible by Norman Solomon, a journalist. And it is about the American empire and its war machine. And I want to bring it up now because in the light of everything we've just discussed, there might be viewers saying, and I want to also background say, look, one of the things I do disagree with Dorothy Day is I'm not a doctrinaire pacifist. I'm against most wars, but I cling basically to a rather strict usage of just war theory. So, all, you know, but I'm very anti-military industrial complex and all those sorts of things. But anyway, that's background to the fact that there are going to be those who are going to listen to this and are going to criticize it on the grounds, hey, sometimes you just got to go to war. You guys are pie in the sky dreamers. You guys are just three theologians with your head in the ivory tower, and you're not down, you know, with
else.
Yeah, exactly. So what I, the reason why I'm pointing to this book, which is this, avoid the I'm going to say it is not pie in the sky dreaming to point to the real world consequences of Catholics in this nation not speaking out against the military industrial complex and America's war machine. We live in a web of lies perpetrated by the mass media and our government, and both parties are war parties. The Democrats, sometimes even more so than the Republicans, for crying out loud. And what this book makes clear, among other books, is that there are, don't tell me I'm a pie in the sky dreamer, damn it. All right. There are real world consequences to America. Now, Bill, you turned me onto this book, so maybe you could lay out for the viewers what your takeaway is from the text. Before we went on the air, you mentioned something about the number of bases and so forth. I think it's really illuminating.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's right down at the bottom of the stairs, the book. But these numbers are pretty close. So this is over the number of overseas bases, and you know, whether I've been calling our country an empire for three decades or so, and people just say that that's way over the top, and that, you know,
yeah.
And then when that book came out about the I forget what it was called, the new theory that the people who became Bush's cabinet developed for America's posture in the world, basically that we can invade anywhere we want in order to
preemptive war. Yeah,
like Weigel argued for preemptive
preventive war.
Yeah. So, you know, they were using the people who wrote this other book were using the word empire, and people said, oh no, empire is just, but this thing, you can't read this book without understanding that you live in an empire. So the bases thing is just a great example. So like China has something like five overseas bases that are off its soil. And the Russians have around 100.
I think that's what the book said, around 100, yeah.
And we have 750 or something. Like,
yeah.
Come on. And my understanding, and this guy makes this pretty clear, is that the reason why we have these is to preserve the shipping routes and the supply chains that make our that guarantee our way of life.
Economy, yeah.
That's right.
It's the, no, it's not, economy is abstract. It's our way of life. It's the way we live. So like if we got rid of the empire, you know, I might not be sitting here with a Wi-Fi that worked. You know, I might not have as much food as I have. I might not be safe. You know, like,
yeah.
I mean, that's what we get for this. It's,
yeah. And the takeaway from this book too, for me, is that essentially since 9/11 in 2001, America has been on essentially a constant war footing. I think one of the weaknesses of the book is it doesn't go back far enough. I think we've been on a constant war footing since the end, since the beginning of World War II.
This guy, he's just talking about his
yeah,
reporting.
His reporting and so on. But this is very, very clear. I mean, America's been on this constant war footing. And the other takeaway for me was the manner in which we allow ourselves to be deceived by the manipulations of the mass media, the journalists, especially, who just don't read. And he, I would say half of this book is him calling out other journalists saying, why didn't you report on this? There's silence on this. Look at this case, this case, this case, this case. And there's silence on this. I go back all the way to, you know, the first Kuwait, the first Iraq war, when the Iraqis invaded Kuwait, 1999, whatever it was. And I remember George Bush,
91.
The first George Bush, President, you know, Herbert Walker Bush, you know, getting on TV, this aggression shall not stand. This aggression shall not stand. And the coalition. But you know what? What it was all about was oil. And you said it right, Bill. What was threatened was our way of life, because there are a lot of nations all over the world that are currently under the domination of some other nation that's invaded, you know, Tibet, whatever, Chinese. OK, we don't do anything about that. But we went into, I guarantee you, if Iraq had invaded some scrub brush territory without any oil, without any strategic significance, we would not have done what we did in that war. And that's part of the fog that gets created in the rhetoric of things. Anyway, end of my diatribe.
But you know, it's a very depressing book. It's hard to read because it's just like, you know.
Yeah, it is.
I want to recommend a book. I feel like similar, along similar lines. I just pulled it off my shelf here that I read last year. It's called 2034. And, a kid in my class, a young man, 27-year-old man, who was in the army and then came back to Regis to be a student, said, I got to read this book. And his commander, he was still in a reserve, and his commander told him to read it to get a picture of how World War III would start. And this book, once you get into it, it's a little hard to get used to. But once you get into it, you see how, like the book starts with, there's this fishing boat in the South China Sea, a Chinese fishing boat, and these this American ship is doing freedom of navigation tours through the South China Sea. They see the boat, they get on top, they board the boat, and they open a box, and there's a computer in it. And then it jumps to like a guy flying missions over the the Iranian border. Suddenly the plane gets taken over and he's forcibly lands in Iran. And the whole scenario is how everything is so computerized now. And the book ends with China dropping two bombs on two U.S. cities, San Diego and Galveston, Texas. And then the United
worthy States candidates
and the United States Larry bombs Shanghai. And it's like, by the time you read this, you think, this is more likely, or something
this could happen.
Similar. This is more likely than it's unlikely to happen. And it's just really sobering in a good way, I think, because, you know, it's kind of like what you're saying. There's 700 bases around the world and they're ready to go. They're ready to go.
They're there for a reason. Yeah. You know, we don't. The other statistic, of course, is that the United States spends more on military than every other nation in the world combined. And that usually shocks. Wait a minute. More than the combination of China, France, Great Britain, Russia. You know, we spend more than them combined. Yeah, we do. That's our military
budget.
And
we're complaining about our budget, you know.
Like, yeah.
And
absolutely. Right. So absolutely.
I have a... What were you
going to say? The Republican Party writes just as many hot checks as the Democrats when it comes to all this stuff.
These are a couple of books that are less depressing. That I thought of. They were part of my things about rights for returning soldiers. But there are these books. I can't remember the names of them or the authors. I can find them. About Greek drama and war. Have you guys?
Jonathan Shea. It's right on my shelf.
And there's another one by a woman about Achilles.
That's Shea too. This is Odysseus in America, and the other ones is Achilles in Vietnam. So there's a whole movement about soul repair, they call it.
And like Achilles hides in his tent because Patroclus has been killed and he's in mourning and he's wounded. And there's a story, the great story that I had in the talk at Duke about this company of actors. So apparently a lot of the classic Greek dramatists were soldiers.
Yeah.
And they wrote plays about soldiers. And this company took these plays around to VA hospitals and they put them on, and sometimes they got the soldiers. I don't remember if they got the soldiers to be in them, but they at least put them on, and this had like these incredible effects, you know. Yeah,
totally open them up. You know, there's another author, we're talking about books now along these lines. His name is David Finkel, and he wrote a book called The Good Soldiers, which is about a year-long tour that a group of soldiers takes in Iraq during the surge, so 07-08. And
under Obama, si se puede Obama, right?
It was as Bush, but it kept going with Obama too. But this was
Obama killed more Afghanis than Bush did with drone attacks.
Yeah, he did the drones. This is like Jermaine would not like drones.
But anyway, I interrupted you, Mike. I'm sorry. I just had to get that dig in.
No, I agree with the point you're making. But then Finkel wrote another book, which is kind of a sequel to The Good Soldiers. It's called Thank You for Your Service. And it's about soldiers who come back and this condition they're in and what they have to go through. Very powerful stuff. Very powerful. I feel like when it comes to peace and all this, like talk about the importance of peace, that returning soldiers have, you know, such an important.
And see, the reason why, and people might be wondering, why are we spending so much time talking about returning soldiers, PTSD, the wounded soul, and so on? It's because the inevitable, like I said, the inevitable criticism of our position is that it's sort of some sort of academic pie in the skyism. But I always like to have these conversations because the fact is war has real horrible consequences, especially modern war. And another neglected factor, we see our soldiers coming home, wounded, maimed, hurt, harmed. But one of the things that this book also points out, War Made Invisible, is that Americans are never really informed in a visceral way that could shake them to their core of what our military does overseas to other human beings. And that we are, in a sense, responsible for real world consequences. This is not pie in the skyism. This is an attempt to, in a sense, hold our nation's feet to the fire and a clarion call for Catholics and other Christians to rise up and say, no, we don't want to be complicit in this war-making machine any longer. That's my sort of two cents here towards the end of our conversation. And I get this all the time. You're just pie in the sky. You're just an academic. You don't know what you're talking about.
What would you say to, I'm asking this because people have said this to me, that climate change is much more important than war.
They're both important.
Stop talking about war. We got to deal with climate change.
No, but the thing is, like when I teach about Laudato Si to my students, we end the course with the problem of how do you have any hope? But then I tell them about growing up in the 70s and 80s where people really thought there could be a nuclear war.
Yeah.
And that,
hey, we're all old enough to remember drop and roll and get under your desk and the drills, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say that. And that you can act hopefully is the only way to have hope. And there were ways to do that, you know, in the 70s and 80s and protesting and so on and doing what you can. And that's kind of the challenge today, even though this generation lives over the, you know, like ecological cloud, we lived under the nuclear cloud, and we still have to act. So I feel like they're both, and they're not entirely unrelated either, right? We know that war has contributed to ecological disaster.
Well, yeah, and I go back to Laudato Si, Pope Francis as well, and others have talked about this. Lots of others have talked about this, that one of the problems that we face is the technological imperative. What you have the power to do technologically, you will do. Because if you don't do it, somebody else will. And this kind of is what drives the arms race. It drives militarism, but it also drives runaway economic growth in ways that's harmful to the environment. This is an unsort of examined aspect of so many of the underlying problems that we face as a society, I think.
So you use the word runaway. I think that's like a Del Shannon, but that's like a big part of this, like, so there's momentum.
Yeah.
Our way of life has this momentum. And the key is that you have to be able to imagine something else. So imagining is like really important. And you know, religious sources are a classic source for reimagining. And then you also need people to imagine with. So that's why I really like the webinar that you did last night, Mike, because you were like imagining, you were showing people images of other things that could be done. But that's one of the things that people don't have is,
right,
the ability to imagine, like what else can happen? What else can we do? We have to do this. And so we have to be able to say, well, maybe you could try this.
I feel like, I think I might have said this last night, but I feel like this is why Dorothy was so devoted to Thérèse Lisieux, because little things are, yeah, power. This is... this is like when she writes about Thérèse at the end of her book on Thérèse, she talks about atomic weapons and bureaucratic culture and society. And then she talks about this alternative, and it's loving people in the kind of moment by moment way that Thérèse exhibits in her life, that maybe there are significant things we can do if we
I agree.
There's such incredible momentum against that.
Yes.
It's an internal logic to it. But Mike, I missed the webinar last night, even though I know it was on, because, you know, to talk about little things, I was preoccupied taking care of newborn goat kids out in our goat shed. And as I was sitting there in my muck boots and my ratty pants with these little goat babies bouncing all over me and pooping on me and whatnot, I actually thought of Therese, and I thought, this is a little thing, and yet it's a kind of a big thing. I don't know how to articulate it right now, but what you just said, I think, is absolutely true. But the moment, like Bill says, the momentum of our culture and our world today is not in the direction of sitting in goat sheds with goat kids.
That's why Ford's article, to go back to that, was so important, because he does kind of have a forecast for how things will unfold if we continue to go on this route. And his article, of course, comes before the dropping of
the bombs,
atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and all that comes after in the Cold War. I guess one thing we can do is write articles like Ford's, right?
Absolutely. Hey guys, this has been great, but we all have places to go, I think. So we should probably wrap this up. But I'll give you guys a chance at some final thoughts here. Bill, any final thoughts?
No, just imagine.
Imagine.
Imagine what to do.
John Lennon.
Dead. No, not him.
Not that stupid song.
Yeah, that I don't know that
song. Worst song ever written.
But anyway.
Well, I mean, yeah, just to go off what Bill was saying, I guess this is why the Eucharist is so important in the liturgy. It really situates us in a setting and a story and a drama that reconfigures these things and puts Christ at the center.
It would help if every once in a while priests talked about that.
It would help.
It would be very nice.
But I tell you, someone who does talk about that, who I think is second to none in developing that Eucharistic concept of our social action, is Bill Kavanaugh, William Kavanaugh, who I just love his stuff on this topic. But anyway, enough of that. We all have places to go, people to see, I guess. And I thank both of you guys. I thought this was a great conversation. Maybe we can put the band together again some other time in the future and do it again. I'm getting a message here on my phone. Yeah, stupid thing. It's connected to the Bluetooth in my headphones, and I'm getting this female voice talking to me right now. But anyway, thanks a lot, guys, and thanks for everyone for listening. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Larry.